I had hoped to go to West Point, but my father told me he could not get me an appointment because it is a highly Republican district. And further than that, I had a defective right arm, a false joint, I believe, which I still have. And therefore, I could not have passed the physical examination. I went to the VMI, largely, I suppose, because my brother went there first. My hope was to be an Army officer, but the prospects looked pretty dim. I suppose I regretted not getting into West Point, and I was particularly concerned because of the additional expense involved in going to the VMI. As to the handicap of not being a West Pointer, that is completely untrue. I think in a way I rather profited by not being a West Pointer, because it was a little bit distangue as I got ahead, and every West Pointer I came in contact with was exceedingly helpful to me. They're among the best friends I had in the Army, and did me a good turn whenever it was possible. The West Point leaders, the chief of staff of West Pointer himself, certainly acted with favor towards me when I was at the Leavenworth, so far as it was in his usual procedure. The rumor that is always prevalent in the Army, that in time of war, that the West Pointers are highly favored, is not true, in my opinion. What happened was pretty much to take the First World War, when I had a good chance to see the whole operation. The appointments to the Army had been largely from West Point, almost entirely from West Point, for a long period of years, since about 1880 and maybe a little earlier. These men were near the top when the First World War came. There were almost none from civil life in the Army at that time in high-ranking positions. A few, but almost none. The most conspicuous example was General Harbord, who was Deputy Chief of Staff and afterwards Commander of the 2nd Division and had risen from the ranks. Certainly it did not detract in the least in his career that he was not a West Pointer. It has to be remembered that in an army such as ours in the time of war, a citizen army, you have a great many officers, particularly in the First World War, who had a very limited training, a very limited amount of training. And they were exceedingly jealous of any apparent preference that was given to a West Pointer. They would compare their own efficiency with that of West Pointers. Now, say the latter half of the class at West Point were ordinary fellows. They had a good education, but they had no special instruction at West Point in to make them great leaders in strategy. They had a fine discipline instilled in them, which meant a great deal and gave a great stability to the Army. But the lower echelons of the class, as a rule, were very undistinguished fellows, though some of our most prominent leaders have come from that region. I always found that I was given the greatest fair treatment in dealings where the question of being a West Pointer or not came out. I remember, as a contrast to what is the popular conception. While I was at Leavenworth, they organized a new bureau called the National Guard Bureau, and a brigadier general was appointed the chief of that bureau. Maybe he was a major general, I don't remember that. But at any event, he chose me to be his assistant while I was still a lieutenant. That would have put me on the general staff as a lieutenant, which had not happened theretofore, and would have been a very rare appointment. I was to be in charge of the training of the National Guard, just a lieutenant, all of the National Guard. And I was notified by the Secretary of the General Staff, unofficially, because he was a great friend of mine, as I just come back from Europe, not to unpack, as I would go to Washington as the head of this division. Then I got another telegram telling me to go ahead and unpack, that I would not be ordered in. Now, I'll have to correct this last, because it relates entirely to another incident, and I will pick up this other story right here. I was at Leavenworth when I was notified that I would go to Washington as deputy chief of this National Guard Bureau, and it'll be a very distinguished appointment. Then I was notified that I would not go, and another officer would take my place. He happened to be a very good friend of mine. But when we found out what had happened was, General Bell had a part in my selection. He was chief of staff, and he certainly was a West Pointer. But the Assistant Secretary of War, who had held the job for many, many years, objected to my appointment because he said that as I was not a West Pointer, it would detract from the position. So it turned out to be a civilian who objected to me as not being a West Pointer, and a West Pointer chief of staff who had selected me for the job. '58. I did run the block a great deal, but I did it through the assistance of my two roommates, Nicholson and Peyton. And they never told anybody else, so it was generally a secret confined to the three of us. In that way, I was able to do it a great deal, and though I was the senior military officer of the class, there was no general suspicion that I was offending in this way. But I was very much in love, and I was willing to take the chance. It was a dismissal offense if they had discovered what I was doing. '59. The statement that I was assigned to room 88 for the reason mentioned is true. I arrived late, and I never forget walking down the long approach avenue to the barracks and hearing the bugle sound, the assembly for parade, dress parade, and seeing the adjutant and the sergeant major strut out to form the line on which the battalion would form. I thought that was they were very wonderful looking figures to me. As to my roommates, I don't remember Gillum. Nicholson, of course, was with me from the first to the last. Later on, Peyton became a roommate, but I rather think this wasn't until my third class year. The trip to Nashville is correct. We went before the Corps was thoroughly drilled, because it was quite early in the season and the whole RAT class were untrained. So that the Corps, I didn't think, made a very good showing. We camped on the exposition grounds. There was no parade of the cadets in Washington while I was a student at the VMI. The only place that we went were Nashville, and later on that same year, the celebration of the Battle of Newmarket. My principal recollection of that is carrying two upperclassmen's rifles through most of the marching. Uh, After the accident, I don't think there was any particular difference in the hazing. It always was rather robust in the earliest weeks, but it continued the entire year, so far as I remember. As to sleeping through the sermons, that is not correct. We may have fallen asleep, but if you did, you were immediately reported and were in trouble. One of my great difficulties when I was a captain was to be careful to stay awake myself, because I had to see that everybody else stayed awake. The hike to House Mountain was correct. I was much impressed by the May 15th roll call, when some designated member of the first class would step forward and salute and say, "Died on the field of honor," as the name of that man was called, if he belonged to the company in which he were in. There were two, I think, in my company. I think that was probably more impressive in my day than it is now, because the little cadet cemetery was in a wooded dale, I guess you'd call it, sort of a little swale, in what is now part of the level parade ground. And my first Newmarket day, Mrs. Stonewall Jackson was one of the spectators when we honored the graves of the five young men, if it was five, who fell at Newmarket. As to the 50-yard dash, I don't remember exactly that. I remember more particularly running for a touchdown one game, rather long run, and then having it called off because somebody had held somebody else. I don't remember the riot with Washington Lee, though there was a first-class riot the first year I was at the VMI. As to the demerits, I don't think it was quite that way, that Peyton and I got no demerits, because Nicholson took them all. What happened was that you often received demerits for some minor untidiness in your room. And Nicholson, the last year, his name was always carried as room orderly. So he would get the touch if anything was wrong. But we all did our work in turn as room orderlies ourselves, though our name wasn't in for that reason. I remember one thing rather amusing that occurred there. My window, either in my second class year, I guess, looked out on the parade ground. And we were going to have a ball game that afternoon, I believe, with the University of Virginia. The teams turned out for practice by earlier in the afternoon than the cadets were allowed to go out. And of course, we all wanted to see the practice. And a number of classmates slipped into my room where they could look out and see the players practicing on the field. They were observed, and the sentinel reported them, called the corporal of the guard. The sentinel's name was Marshall. The corporal of the guard's name was Marshall. He went in and reported to the officer of the day, who was Marshall. There may have been a sergeant of the guard, but anyway, everybody was Marshall until it got to the commandant, and he was Marshall. The comment about Sergeant Wolf and polishing the stock of the rifle was correct. A number of us did that. The feast in my room that they're referring to, I think, was an occasion where my mother was sick. and was therefore not able to prepare me a Christmas box. Every fellow received one of these as a rule, and everybody had boxes, and I didn't. My roommates did. So sometime after Christmas, a couple of weeks maybe, my father in Pittsburgh went into the big delicatessen store and ordered a whole barrel of things, which included the canned goods that you could get in those days and all the delicacies that could be packed up in that way. It was delivered in my room and the entire class assembled there, I think. I remember myself being crowded up to the radiator where I could sit on that and watching them eating. We tried to pick out a few things that we could hold for late feasts for ourselves, but I don't recall that we were able to hold anything out, because this was a rare treat and nobody was receiving any food at that time. And as I've never said before, I don't think to you, the food at that time was something terrific. I don't recall the business of Fleming and the oysters. My first wife was Elizabeth Carter Coles. She was a very lovely looking woman. I guess you might call her a beauty. She was the finest amateur pianist I ever heard. And I think I've already explained that I'd heard her playing, and that brought about my meeting with her. We became steadies, you might say, very, very shortly, just a few weeks, and were engaged for the last year and a half I was there, and married shortly after I left there. We were married for 25 years when she died after an operation at the Walter Reed Hospital. She had a very bad heart, which had occurred before we met, and from excess strain of social things, and finally culminated in St. Louis, where she was bridesmaid and maid of honor and so on at one or two weddings of her friends out there. It was called mitral regurgitation. Her mother was Miss Pendleton of Virginia, and one of her progenitors, direct, I think I mentioned, is buried at the head of the aisle next to the altar in the famous Brunton Chapel at Williamsburg. He was the signer of the Declaration of Independence and would be occasionally mentioned when any question of family came up. They were rather contemptuous of me because the name of my hometown sounded like a very recent affair, and they were rather shocked when they found out it is much older than Lexington, Virginia, because it is a famous stopping place on the National Pike after coming over the mountains, or before starting up the mountains, which are only a mile away. That's correct about my teaching at Danville. That's correct about the honeymoon. The New Willard Hotel at that time, as I recall, was had very recently opened, and we stayed there. I know there were two theaters running in Washington then, so there was some theaters to go to, although no movies. But what was novel were the taxis, the motor taxis, which, strange to say, were made after the style of the Hansom cab, where the driver sat on top and you sat under him inside. We used those quite a bit to divert ourselves. I won't comment on the professors of the VMI, except Colonel Nichols, who later became superintendent and was a very fine friend of mine and very warmly supported me. Frankly, I didn't like practically any subject best. In trying to think about it, I can't recall now anyone which pleased me. I was a very poor student, And as I've already said, I did very, very badly my first year. I think I was 35th in a class of 100 and something. But I ended up, I believe, in my last year as 5th in my class. Ambition had begun to set in, but I started rather late. Of the books that I read at that time, it was pretty much anything I could get my hands on, particularly the last year and a half. I didn't discover until about then that my roommate Nicholson was, he and his brothers were orphans, and they owned the Times-Picayune, which was just merely the Picayune paper of New Orleans. He made a casual remark one day that they got all these books to review, and they sold them for 5 cents apiece. So we immediately got him in contact with a friend of his on the paper, and the friend would send us a barrel of books at a time. You'll find on the register there the record of books contributed to the library by Nicholson. That's the way it came about. I was a fast reader, a rapid reader, and Peyton was a rapid reader, and Nicholson was a very slow reader. Peyton and I just read through the barrel, and finally a very thin, stern, sort of Creole-like character, a lawyer, a Mr. Rapier, arrived at the VMI, and he was Nicholson's guardian. And it was a few days, about a day at least, before we discovered, Peyton and I, that we were the ones that were being investigated, because Nicholson was not standing well, and they thought maybe we were a poor influence. But it developed that Peyton was third in the class, and I was about 12 or 15, and Nicholson was next to the last. So Mr. Rapier gave up the idea that we were a bad influence. The reading, though, was bad, because Nicholson read very slowly, and that absorbed a great deal of time. So they directed that the books supply be turned off. However, he managed to get other deliveries, and we continued to read quite a bit. I read a little in the library. I remember coming across for the first time Rudyard Kipling, and I read every book they had by Kipling. I don't remember the others that I read there, though I think I did read some on historical accounts of life in Virginia in the early days. The appearance of the VMI, in part, is very much the same, but the courtyard looks differently because it's closed at one end very firmly. They did put a building there just before I left, but that was not satisfactory, so the present firm continuation of the barracks and the additional barrack, which extends beyond and which includes the martial arch, which they complimented me by giving my name to it. The parade ground is much larger. The little woodland where the Newmarket boys were buried is no longer in existence. The new buildings along the lane leading up to the VMI were entirely new. Over the parapet, as we call it, beyond the road, there was nothing then but woodland. Now it's all of that is generally filled up with buildings, including the gymnasium, which is quite a structure directly in front of the main archway, but far below it. The mess hall now is a single-story building. It was then a two-story building. The little shacks, almost as they were, coming down the hill to the mess hall have been replaced. I believe maybe one is there with the upstairs veranda on it. anywhere. It is where the military storekeeper, Major Colonel Poog, held forth, who I discovered after I left there was a very celebrated artillerist in Lee's army, and played a very prominent part in a great many battles, particularly in the Wilderness, Spotsylvania Courthouse, and at the opening of the Battle of Antietam. The routine life of the cadet in those days was very austere, I might say. We had they didn't make any provision for our entertainment. They'd have a dance, I think, very seldom. And I never went to the dances in my early days there because the position of the new cadet was so humble that it is easier for me to stay away than it was to go. So I didn't go. I didn't go out socially, I think, at all for the first 2 years that I was there. And we would go uptown on Saturday afternoon and window shop, and there was no movies, of course. And there was a famous little store there on the corner, Dole's, we called it, and he was quite a character and made a great point of favoring the cadets. On Sunday afternoon, we were allowed to go in the back country, but not uptown. We couldn't go till after midday roll call, and we had to be back for evening parade. I remember one very ridiculous thing happened back there. We killed a duck, and the farmer caught us at it before we could carve the duck up and cook him. And so we had to take up a collection to pay for the duck or be reported. We had very little money, any of us, but taking about all our money together, we paid for the duck. And after we settled with the farm, we looked around, the duck had walked off. We'd paid the money and didn't have any duck. The routine of cadet life I became accustomed to and accepted. I think I was a little bit more philosophical about this thing than a good many boys. They would get very exercised over things of that, something of that kind, but we had to, it was part of a business, and the only thing to do was accept it as best you could and as easily as you could, and that I tried to do, and I think I was fairly successful in doing it. A good bit, of course, depended on your roommates. If they were agreeable fellows, well, you're all right. If they weren't, well, you were in trouble. Mine were very agreeable. In 67, you asked me who were my friends besides Gillum and Fleming. I don't even remember them. As the time went on, there were others that became pretty warm friends of mine. The older McCabe boy, Erskine Miller from Stanton, and the Johnson brothers, or cousins, I don't recall which it was, and those I remember in particular. I'd be hard to say what at the VMI, what particular thing interested me most. Of course, I was being disciplined, and I was learning discipline, and I was learning responsibility. And of course, that is particularly the case as I rose in cadet rank, where I had very great responsibility. And quite different from that at West Point. At the VMI, I never remember a tactical officer coming into the mess hall more than three or four times in the year. It may have been oftener, but that's all I recall. So I was responsible for the entire corps in the mess hall every meal all through the year. And if I do say it, it was run with hardly a loud laugh. I only had to move the corps out once ahead of time while they were still eating, when they had a new dessert. Maybe it was strawberries. Whatever it was, there was a complete silence while they're eating, and that attracted some fellow's attention. So he shushed the rest, and they all settled down to a complete silence and then looked at me to see what I was going to do. It happened at that time there'd been a famous case up at West Point of giving a silence to a tactical officer, meaning a sub-professor, and that had attracted a great deal of attention. I don't know what that got involved in a congressional investigation. But anyway, that added to this silence, and they all turned to look at me to see what I was going to do. I had a small table there with three others, and I merely got up and called them to attention and marched them out of the mess hall when the strawberries were only about a third eaten. The routine of cadet life that got me most was the early morning. I never did like that. But I suppose that's same with all boys. And it was early morning. We generally got up in the dark. We took rather pride in sleeping with these very wide double windows wide open. In fact, the older cadets made you do it when you were a new cadet. And the snow would fly in on us. And we had a strap around the blankets and the bunk to keep the covers from coming off of us, and we just slept like dead men, which meant we were in very good health. Whatever we may say about the diet, we were in very good health. Lexington at that time was a little smaller town. One end of it out towards the cemetery, beyond the cemetery, has been much developed since those days. But it doesn't change a great deal. And it's pretty much the same town it was in my day. I think it's probably affected more by the fact that Warson Lee has a much larger enrollment, and of course those men are free to be in town whenever they want to be. What I learned most at the VMI was self-control, discipline. So it was ground in, and the problem of managing men, which fell to the cadet non-commissioned officer and cadet officer. He was very severely judged by his classmates if he was slack. They might be willing to try to pull things which would give him the reputation of being slack, but at the same time would judge you very severely if you proved to be a very slack performer in the business of your military grade. I don't recall any distinguished visitors coming there except once when I was officer of the guard or officer of the day, I forget which. Anyway, I was in the little room right in the Sallyport, which was then the office of the officer of the day, and where the delinquency book was kept. And a very stern-looking man came in. He was an officer of the army. He had on a blue cape with a yellow lining and the yellow stripes on his blue trousers. And he wanted to see Cadet Godfrey. Then I realized that this was Colonel Godfrey of the famous 7th Cavalry, who took a leading part in the Custer Battle, the Little Bighorn, and wrote a very interesting and authoritative account of it for Harper's or the Century Magazine years before. When I told young Godfrey that his father was here, he looked like he'd been shot. Apparently he was under very stern parental discipline and he wasn't doing very well. I remember another occasion that stuck with me. In the archway, the Sallyport we called it, There was an old fella with a scraggly beard, and he was so sunburned and dark he looked like he was a colored man. And he sat there and sold nuts and things like that that he'd collected up on the mountain. One of the cadet officials ordered the old man out of the archway. It may have been a sub-professor, I'm not quite certain. But anyway, later on he was sent for by General Shipp, and in the general's very ponderous voice, very stern voice, he was informed that that man was a veteran of the Confederate Army, the Confederate Cavalry, with a very fine record, and he could sit in that arch until he died. So the man with the nuts came back. There was no family opposition to my becoming an officer. I did not visit battlefields a great deal during that period. I didn't have a chance because the session lasted from September to middle or late June, once at least to July 4th, and there was no opportunity to get to battlefields, and also there were no automobiles. I was greatly influenced by the traditions concerning General Lee and General Jackson. They were both buried there. I went to frequent services in the Washington Lee Chapel, where the effigy of General Lee rested behind the chapel over the vault in which he is buried. And I had plenty of time to reflect. I might say, incidentally, I got persuaded General Pershing to go to the VMI after he'd finished a visit to West Point when he first came back from France. And he was received in the Washington Lee Chapel, a great ceremony, and stood in front of the effigy of General Lee and made his remarks. And we immediately received quite a clamor from certain men in Chicago and others who objected to General Pershing going there where Lee was buried. And I remember General Pershing left me to answer all the letters. He said, "You got me to go there. Now you tend to the letters objecting to my having gone." I used to be impressed with the recollection of the famous March on Washington by Early, which started at Lynchburg. And considering the distance they would march a day, slogging up those bad roads of that period, it was a long, tedious performance. And it was quite surprising he could go so far without the troops being mobilized against him. But the thing that stuck in my mind was that when I would go to the cemetery, or go by the cemetery, was that his whole column turned in there on its march without halting and moved into the cemetery, circled Stonewall Jackson's grave, and went on up the pike towards Washington. As to the Spanish-American War, I got very little. The newspapers, of course, were lurid, and they soon changed from plain descriptions into antagonistic accounts of one commander or the other. There were attacks in the Navy that was occupied all the attention. And General Miles came back and made some comment about this trial of the admirals, investigation of the admirals, and Theodore Roosevelt reprimanded him so that everybody around the upstairs of the White House could hear the reprimand. In that way, the aftermath of the war was not very wholesome, but at least gave you an idea what democracy could do, and particularly what politics can do in military matters during and particularly after a war. I don't think my training in the last year had any particular change resulting from our experience in the war. I remember that, more particularly, I remember having to drill a new cadet who'd been in the war, and that was quite a performance, watched by everybody with keen interest. The only one of the leaders you mentioned that I met afterwards was General Wood. And that's quite a story, and I'll tell it at some later time. As to the war, I might state that we know pretty well what happened in the preparations for the Battle of Santiago. The difficulty we had. I remember one ship captain, I traveled on his boat later on, was telling me how this quartermaster directed to tie his boat to a tree. He said he was running out of coal and he wanted to get coal up. And the quartermaster who was directing the landing said he couldn't go. Well, of course, that meant the boat would be helpless there, off a rough coast with no coal to keep engine headway. And afterwards, they'd be in still greater difficulty. So this Army quartermaster directed the captain to stay there, like I tell you, and tie your boat to a tree, which is a new form of ship business, even for those days. Next indication of, the first indication of complete lack of preparedness was the assembly of the Army down at Tampa. Literally everything was wrong. It wasn't so much wrong in a sense as it was lacking. And if it hadn't been for the resort hotels there where they could all sit on the porch and rock, some of the leaders and the press, it would have been a very grave business. Roosevelt and Wood were the Rough Riders, highlighted the affair and sort of took the painfulness out of that situation. But there wasn't practically anything in the way of preparation, and the troops had been gotten together from the western posts, company by company, and assembled there almost for the first time since the Civil War. The best explanation of the situation on the West Coast was that, as I recall, and I dug this myself up out of the records, the first expedition sailed for the Philippines, 7,000 miles away, which were still in the hands of the Spaniards, and an insurrecto army of the Filipinos under Aguinaldo rapidly forming. It sailed with 150 rounds of ammunition per man. Now, at that time, I think the amount of ammunition you're supposed to have, not at that time, but a little later, the amount of ammunition you're supposed to have on the man, in the train immediately behind the division, and in this other train a couple of days march back, was something like 700, and all of these reserves were then available in this country to fill it out. Here they were going 7,000 miles from home with 150 rounds per man, and God knows when they'd get any more, if there was any more ammunition suitable for those rifles, like our tremendous shortage in 1939. It was a sorry dilemma, and only the gallantry, individual, and initiative of the men, the leaders, and the extreme weakness of the Spanish army, which is debilitated by disease and all in both Cuba and in the Philippines, made it possible to go through the early fighting up to the surrender to the Spanish, up to the surrender by the Spanish, without some great catastrophe befalling us. Was I made to feel that I was Yankee to VMI? Yes, quite a bit. I was hazed on my accent up to the day of my graduation. And I remember that when I was called on to make a speech by a class dinner honoring the occasion of naming this arts for me, that my principal twist that I gave to it was that while they were these Southern fellas, largely, and while they pretty much kept the pressure on me on account of my Northern accent and all, I happened to be the one and the only one who had an arts name for him down at the VMI. But they were hazing me, as it were, even up the time I was a first captain, about my accent, which had a little bit of the twang that is common to Pittsburgh. It had improved a little bit with my first marriage, but it was always referred to in a rather derogatory manner. Social life. As I've said before, I didn't go out practically at all my first 2 years, and very little after that, until I became interested in my future wife, and my social life then was concerned practically only with her, and whenever we could, we would go driving, because she had a fine little horse and stand-up trap where the lady sits up on a slightly raised seat and has a whip with a long lash. At the VMI, I studied German and came away knowing about a dozen words. I knew a little bit about German grammar. I also studied French, and I came away knowing less. I wasted all my language instruction, and it is the great fault, I think, of languages today in America. They're so busy teaching you grammar and things of that sort, they don't teach you how to talk. You've got to learn a language, really, by starting like a child does. And they taught the officers Chinese beautifully without our going into any grammar at all. I could conduct an ordinary conversation in Chinese while I was out there the first time. It didn't do me much good when I got back here, because all the laundrymen spoke Cantonese, and the others were largely the dialect of Shanghai, and it seemed to me I seldom encountered anybody who spoke the Mandarin, which was the language of about 200 million in the north. Of course, if I'd been in Washington going to the embassy, I would have run into that there, but everybody at the embassy spoke English. So far as I can see about the VMI today, it's much less strict, generous in vacations, particularly expensive, comparatively speaking, in what the cadets would spend for their dances and things of that sort. We had spent very little money. We had very little money, and I think we got along much happier. Now, I will now go back to some of the questions and some of the matters concerning my youth. In the first place, I want to add some little to what I gave before. First, as to my reading, I remember now the name of the one book that I thought was so perfectly written by Conan Doyle, and which you evidently never read. That was The Refugees, which began in the court of Louis the 14th and ended up with the Iroquois Indians in Canada. I thought that was one of the most wonderful book of descriptions that I had ever read. I still do, and I've had three or four copies of it, but they've always been carried off by somebody that's borrowed them. Another book that I remember my father reading to us was the Wandering Jew. And about an hour ago, I remember two or three more, but I can't think of them right now. That was a very lengthy book, I recall. One. My father's parents and my mother's parents died before I was born. Therefore, I never had any living grandparents. Father told me something of them. Mother told me quite a little of them, but they were not striking things. She was very proud of her father, who was a doctor, for his handling of affairs during the great cholera epidemic. I think it was in the 70s. And may have been back in the 60s, but I think it was in the 70s. I know she told me that he was out so much, he rode horseback on his appointments, that he'd gotten to such a state of fatigue that the horse brought him home. He'd fall asleep on the horse and it brought him home to the stable three times in one night before he ever finally made the patient. She also told me that he himself had developed the saline injection treatment for cholera, which I knew later on in my cholera experiences, which were pretty lively in the Philippines. And that was the only thing that we had that seemed to be very effective. The only trouble was you cured the man of cholera and he died of heart failure while he was so weakened. My father, I remember my mother telling me, my father's father ran for the Senate, as I recall, twice, and my mother's father became a very ardent opponent. Not that he was appealing for office himself, but he was opposed to father's father being a United States Senator. The result is their families didn't speak, and then it ended up with my father's sister marrying my mother's brother, so I had double first cousins. But I know that my mother and father had to wait until one of their fathers had died before they could dare to marry. I don't recall Father telling me any particular story about the Kentucky Marshals, except that they came to Kentucky, as I recall, with the father of Chief Justice Marshall, who remained in Virginia. But his father settled there near Maysville, Kentucky, near a town called Little Washington later on. And that was the beginning of the Marshall family in Kentucky. That's not so far from Augusta, which is my father's home. Both, incidentally, I guess this question is down here later, but I'll tell you now, my brother and sister were both born in Kentucky. I was born in Pennsylvania. The family, I think, had moved to Pennsylvania the time they were born, at least the time my sister was born. But my mother went there for the birth of the children. I visited Augusta several times for about a month at a time, and I went to Maysville for a very brief visit, not in Maysville, but out in the country, which was the home, first home of the Marshalls. The homes of the, in Kentucky, of the members of the family were all in towns. There were very little country life in those days like there was in Virginia on the East Coast. I heard a great many Indian legends of that period, more tales than I read, of course, of Daniel Boone and Simon Kenton and Girty and of their day. My mother always referred to Kentucky in describing this period to me as the dark and bloody ground, which I believe it was called in those days. I remember as a young fella thinking it was a very beautiful countryside, particularly out towards Maysville. The comments about Fred H-A-L-L-O-W, I don't know. I don't remember him. I remember the colored man who cut the lawn, if that was his name. And he was always arguing for more pay, which I think he was entitled to because he got very little in those days. I remember Mother's hickory nut cake and her caramel cake, and except for getting hickory nuts, I didn't help her very much. When she made the ordinary cake, like caramel cake, she always made a little one for me, which I could eat right away. So I'd sit down with a small cake and a glass of milk and generally eat it all up right off. I don't remember any particular Thanksgiving affairs, though of course we had a Thanksgiving dinner. Mother played on the piano. I think I've already explained that we had a good bit of music in the family because my father sang very well. He had a fine tenor voice. My mother both played and sang. She had studied in Philadelphia when she was a girl coming up from Kentucky because she had an aunt who lived in whatever that famous square is there. In
Rittenhouse Square?
Rittenhouse Square.
Rittenhouse Square.
My principal recollection of Rittenhouse Square, and this isn't to be published, incidentally, because I can't root into the other part of the family, was that the husband of one of the relatives was a pretty lively chap, and he belonged to the Philadelphia City Troop, and I like the description of his hip boots and sword, plumed hat, and a very, very fancy coatee or coat, and particularly the description of his falling down the stairs in this uniform, plumed hat and all, and being picked up unconscious at the bottom of the steps. But Mother loved to play, was very willing with the music, and with my brother playing two or three instruments and singing fairly well, but very pleasantly for a young man, and my sister singing. I was the only one who didn't come up to the general standard of the family, though I did play a little on the piano, a little on the banjo, and a little on the guitar. The music I liked was the semi-classical, and I don't remember the Battle of Waterloo, so far as music is concerned. We did not have regular singing. Mother and father would sing together, and I didn't much like that because I had to sit around on a hassock and listen and keep quiet. It was a little too long for me, and I believe I've already said my principal recollection of the song was "When the Swallows Homeward Fly," and I didn't like that, and I imitated it and got a licking for doing it. No, our home did not have the illustrated life of Napoleon or of Lincoln. I think there was a history of Lincoln and Napoleon there, but I don't recall just what it was. There were a good many of the illustrated books common to that day with the steel engravings. I remember the Homestead strike very well, the day it happened, all the things about it. The Molly Maguires had father on the blacklist. They killed his partner, and they almost got him, and they threatened to assassinate him in order to frighten him into not giving testimony, which convicted the assassin of his partner, which had to do with the brim of a hat. He had a very hard time with the strike business, and I remember as a young boy being down at the works at a place called Percy, and seeing a striker's army, well, I suppose 500, maybe 1,000, largely armed with the poles of the pitchfork time wired to the end. On one occasion I was standing on the tipple through which the coal was shot down into the cars. No, rather, I was sitting on the edge of a freight car, open freight car, which was below the tipple, and waiting for it to load, when a lump of rock coal was thrown from outside the picket line and struck the tipple and came down the chute and hit me over the eye and knocked me out. I have a slight bluish scar there today. It's very hard to see now. But the whole Molly Maguire business appealed to me very strongly, and I was quite thrilled by the procedure which led to the conviction of so many of them when this detective became a member. But this was largely in eastern Pennsylvania rather than western, though they were there. As I say, my father barely escaped assassination, and his partner was assassinated. I don't recall any particular reactions to Andrew Carnegie and H.C. Frick, except they were great dominating influences. Frick more than Carnegie, because he was more actively in the game as I grew to a more appreciative age. But I was quite familiar with Carnegie's build-up of great fortune, and I felt Frick was a very stern man.
I'm going to switch it over.